Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Casey Anthony.
And
it's good
to have you out. It's good to have you out again. The only reason
people care about anything is Casey Anthony.
No, let me just say,
wait, this is
you're stealing next week's podcast material because she won't actually be out of jail until July the 13th.
Wait a second, there's a podcast next week? You'd be that optimistic? I was watching, because I was at the gym this week.
The gym?
As you can tell.
Gym who?
Yeah, exactly, in gymnasium. I was watching both MSNBC and Fox, and they had commentators on both networks for an hour complaining about the media saturation about the Casey Anthony trial.
I think it's been absolutely unconscionable the way the media can't talk about anything but Casey Anthony.
So instead of Casey Anthony, we should talk about the other big battle this week, the battle for Republican financial supremacy.
You mean not the debt ceiling and the deficit that faces our nation?
Well,
and is
no, but that is important. But we are taping this podcast on Thursday morning, and as we speak, congressional leaders are at the White House meeting with President Obama.
The tension is incredible.
Well, it's important stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it is important stuff.
Yeah.
And it's actually a really philosophical conversation about the role of government.
Yes, it is. It's not just about trillions of dollars, although trillions of dollars do matter. It is about the entire philosophy of our government and our nation.
And I'm not taking sides here, but, I mean, the Republicans campaigned on and were elected on less government and no taxes and reducing the size of government. And not that the Democrats were campaigning on raising
big government,
taxes,
higher taxes.
Well, but I mean
fewer jobs, you know.
But some Democrats, the White House is saying that, okay, Social Security is on the table, Medicare is on the table, entitlement programs are on the table, but you Republicans also have to talk about taxes, and they're to this, you know, Mitch McConnell, other Eric Cantor, to a person, they say,
All right, this is not a fiscal policy podcast, and we're not going to go down into the weeds, but let me just say that as things stand right now, we have a August 2nd deadline at which time the government can no longer hide the fact that it has reached the debt ceiling and therefore is in danger of being in default on its rollover of previously issued borrowing instruments. Okay, that is the situation. Practically speaking, no deal is going to be able to be put in place in less than, say, a couple of weeks. So a functional deadline is July 22nd. That is less than 2 weeks away. So the negotiations going on at the White House right as we record this podcast are going to have to get serious, or we are going to be banging into that final deadline. Sooner or later, the bond market is going to start to take this amiss. Obviously, it has been on the minds of investors for a long time. And if we are not going to be able to get past this, we are going to have something akin to the sort of panic that sweeps through the markets every time people think Greece is going to default or Portugal
or a different Broadway play.
Or Ireland, right.
Right. Cats.
Or possibly Spider-Man. So if we run into that kind of danger and we get that kind of impetus for a deal, we may see a deal done on the brink at the very last moment. But there are some of us who are still holding out some hope that these highly respected, wonderful leaders that we have from Congress and in the White House will be able to work something out on a slightly more rational schedule beginning immediately, as in today.
Well, two things that happened in the last couple of days that made me think something was afoot. One is that the fact that John Boehner, Speaker of the House, did meet secretly with President Obama last weekend.
Don't tell
the Republicans.
And the rumor is that he put $1 trillion in revenue collection
now, not
on
tax
the table.
Increases,
oh, of course not. Never,
but
never
but
tax
closing
increases.
Loopholes, which, you know, mm-hmm, I mean,
sure, like, close those loopholes.
That's right.
You know,
apparently
trillions of dollars going out through those loopholes.
There are.
And the Speaker was willing to actually restrain some of those dollars from leaving.
And the other thing is, it seems like when you talk to the rank and file, Democrats and Republicans, neither side seems happy, which makes you think that
that's good.
That something is going to about to
even
about
more
happen.
Interesting. And they came out of the White House today. They have already
Thursday.
Told us. They have already told us they're not going to talk to the media.
Right, yeah.
And you know what?
That's a good sign.
Good sign.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a very good sign. All right, I think we're on the same wavelength here. And while we're talking about trillions of dollars, let's talk about how much money is being raised by the people who would like to have the job in the White House.
Well, we don't have the numbers of President Obama yet, but we do have most of the Republican field. And the seeming headlines of the week was that Mitt Romney, to no one's surprise, was the big winner. $18.3 million. What his take in the second quarter of 2011 was more than twice as much as the rest of the Republican field.
On the other hand,
one, we have not heard from Michelle Bachmann yet, but more importantly, The guess had been that Romney would raise far more than the $18.3 million.
He was supposed to be well over 20, and most of that $18 million came in one event that raised $10 million.
Right, in Las Vegas, and in one day, he raised more money in this quarter in 2007, although he spent far more.
And if he goes back out to Vegas, he could lose that $10 million and maybe
well,
more.
I think he could. And also, if you compare it to George W. Bush in 1999, Bush raised twice as much as Romney. So you could say...
Even though that was still a pretty lively field, it was not as though it were... You know, just George W. Bush
well,
and nobody else.
It was John McCain.
He was clearly
Forbes,
number one. But
Lamar
they were
Alexander.
Exactly.
Right.
So this was not a case of let's all give our money to the one guy we know is going to win anyway
right.
in 1999. Whereas here we are in 2011, and there does not appear to be, other than Michelle Bachmann, another candidate who's on the move. Newt Gingrich, what? Raised $1 million?
Raised $2 million, but is $1 million in debt. Ron Paul raised $4.5 million, most of that online.
Oh, but I mean, online,
right?
Ron Paul has always been an online candidate.
Tim Pawlenty, on the other hand, raised $4.2 million, far less than one would have hoped if you were a Tim Pawlenty fan.
The Tim Pawlenty campaign, almost as much as the Newt Gingrich campaign, has been hogging the headline as the disappointment thus far in 2011 because. In the bumper cars dynamic of all this, Sarah Palin's not getting in and Michelle Bachmann getting in, partly in response to Sarah Palin not getting in, has really knocked a lot of the pinions out from under Tim Pawlenty's campaign. He was supposed to be the guy in Iowa who would beat Romney there.
Right.
And now it looks like Michelle Bachmann's going to be the bigger challenger in Iowa.
She's certainly contesting it.
Yes, native Iowan. All right. Big changes there, big, big negatives for Tim Pawlenty. And now he has a campaign controversy over Vin Weber, his campaign chairman, somebody who's been on NPR a lot, somebody a lot of folks respect here in Washington.
Including me.
And he has said some things about what their strategy is that makes sense to some folks. But then Pawlenty says, no, that's not quite our strategy. I mean, it's one of those kind of campaign stories. Nothing seems to be going right.
Well, Vin Weber did say that one of the reasons Michelle Bachmann is doing so well in Iowa is part of her sex appeal. And he apologized immediately, and Pawlenty chastised him for it. Vin Weber knows better, and I think that was just a slip. But one person we haven't mentioned is John Huntsman, who raised over $4 million.
But mostly from a single donor.
Well, no, he's married. Almost half of his money.
Almost half of his money came from his other pocket.
That's right, yeah.
You know, that's just not the best way to finance your campaign, although there have been those who have made a success of it. Romney contributed a lot to his campaign in 2008.
Right.
Obviously, Ross Perot was a self-financing candidate right. back in 92 and 96. But it has not been the path.
Yeah, I'm not still sure what all these numbers mean. First of all, as we saw in 2010, there were a lot of independent expenditures that really carried the day and made a big difference, and they were not in the candidate receipts, the intake and spending, things like that.
But we're talking about the early primary phase where you're trying to get credibility.
Right, right. A lot of it is just, perception. This money thing is a perception thing. But remember, 4 years ago, the polls in New Hampshire, 4 years ago this week, Romney was first in the polls, Rudy Giuliani was second, Fred Thompson was third, John McCain was fourth. So, we could talk about a year in advance what all these numbers mean, but...
You just brought up that list so you could say Fred Thompson. That's the truth, isn't it? You just like to bring up Fred Thompson and rub my face in it. Well, let me ask you this.
You're more sensitive about this.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah, Ken.
Who will be the Fred Thompson of 2012? I have a candidate for you.
I'm guessing Fred Thompson.
No, it's Thad McCotter.
Thad McCotter?
Thad McCotter has gotten in the race. He has gotten in the race. Don't be so Thad.
I'm Thad.
Don't be so...
Sorry. Look,
I know a lot of the listener is probably thinking right now, wait, that's a character in Harry Potter. That's not an actual person.
The listener is thinking, I want to take what they're taking.
The Thad McCotter juggernaut launched this week in Michigan.
What was that all about?
Well, Thad McCotter, who is a member of Congress from Michigan,
right.
He's been here going on a decade.
2002, right.
Lots of people don't know who he is.
Including?
In fact, virtually everyone. So the question is, yes, he plays rock guitar. Apparently he's pretty good.
Yes.
He played for a group called the Flying Squirrels. Anyway, he is taking the position that he is as well qualified as many of the people in the actual field.
Well, he heard probably the podcast mention that the Republican electorate out there is not satisfied with the quality of candidates. Therefore, what America needs is Thad McCotter. What McCotter does bring, and we can make all the jokes we want, none of which are funny, but the thing is, he is among the few Republican members of Congress who is seen as pro auto union, if not pro-union. I mean, he has a 36% lifetime voting record for the AFL-CIO, which is a lot for a Republican.
It sets him apart from the field.
But it also sets him apart from Mitt Romney in the Michigan Republican primary or caucus, whatever they have, because Mitt Romney opposed the auto bailout. As a congressman from suburban Detroit, McCarter supported it. And I don't know if it's a little, you know, slap out at Mitt Romney, or he just thinks that he brings to the table what other candidates don't.
And also he asked himself why. In the several years we've been doing this podcast, we had never had occasion to mention the Thad McCarter factor.
No, we have not. No.
Now we have. Yeah. So
that's
he
the end.
Is that far ahead. Okay. Another first this week, the first Twitter town hall held in the White House.
I didn't get much out of this town hall meeting for the president.
Oh, you must have watched it then.
Well, I counted the characters. Now, there are 140 characters. Now, there are only two characters here.
There were a lot more characters than that in the East Room. Yeah. And the thing that everyone observed about this...
The questions were 140 characters.
But
and the
answers
were
140 minutes. Yeah. No, it was...
An advertisement for Twitter.
It was a huge advertisement for Twitter. I felt like the president didn't really get into the spirit of this thing. I mean, he was a little dyspeptic right from the beginning. It seemed like he was distracted. He wasn't really having any fun with it. If you're not going to have fun with social media, you're not going to get invited out again.
No, but you remember the other day, Rick Perry talked about he's going to send things out on Twitter. You know that he really did say that.
That's just how they say the word in Texas. It's
a
different accent.
And where is Rick Perry in all this? We talked about money, and he is talking to fundraisers out in California.
I still find it a little difficult to believe that Rick Perry is actually running for president. But I think he loves having his name mentioned. I think he loves being the new Haley Barbour, the new Mitch
Daniels. Exactly what Haley Barbour did. He was doing the moves as if he were preparing to run, and then he at the last second he said, well, it's not going to happen.
So we still remain in the camp that says Rick Perry, despite all other indications, despite his sending staff into New Hampshire and starting to sort of feel out donors here and there, is not really serious about running.
But he would make an interesting candidate. I think he appeals to the Michelle Bachmann.
He's another conservative.
Well, everybody, see, that this is good news for Romney, perhaps, because everybody's the alternative to Mitt
Romney.
Just
as good as a Xerox. Yeah. Well, no, I think Perry is significantly different. He does speak more to a Southern strain in the party and more to, if you will, a more specific Texas strain in the party, which was not popular after the second term of George W. Bush, but which is making something of a comeback, or inevitably will, as the troubles of the economy continue and as people look around for an option or an alternative to Barack Obama.
Do you buy the argument that he is too similar to George W. Bush? I don't at all. Everybody sees, oh, look, Texas governor, therefore he's another George W. Bush. They don't even like, they never liked each other.
It's not an alliance. He's not another member of the family. He's
not
been part of the family's political operation. He's not run by Karl Rove. And I just...
That whole group backed Kay Bailey Hutchison
exactly,
in 2010.
Exactly. So it's not the same old gang making another grab for power. And the thing about Rick Perry is he is a real Texan. I mean, to whatever degree W had become a Texan, Rick Perry's a real Texan, and he's going to strike people as one, and that would not necessarily be an asset in every early primary state.
Although, as we have pointed out in the past, an Al Gore supporter in 1988.
As he was a Democrat at that time, as many Texas conservatives were before they switched to the Republican Party. All right, we talked about some of the national issues. On the state and local level, lots of interesting things going on, including an extraordinary episode in the history of the previously thought to be progressive blue state of Minnesota.
Well, it's still progressive, and it's still basically a blue state, at least with presidential elections. But here's what's so amazing about this. First of all, it's always had the reputation of good government.
Hubert Humphrey.
Well, Hubert Humphrey.
Walter Mondale. Minnesota has always been thought of as a fairly government-friendly kind of state. Well,
high voting percentages?
Well, they now have a new liberal governor in Mark Dayton, but they have a highly conservative Republican legislature, and the two of them have been at such loggerheads. Tell me if this reminds you of any other political body that you can think of, any other polity you know of.
The United States of America, the Congress?
They have gone to the mat and said, okay, fine, if we can't get a budget, we're just going to start shutting the state government down. So the prisons are operating and there are still cops, but you can't get a fishing license in the state of Minnesota
July 4th
in July.
July 4th weekend, all the parks were closed.
In
right.
July.
Fishing and hunting licenses, right.
This is not the way.
Well, let's just go back to 2010. Whatever. Here's the message that came out of Minnesota. For the first time in 20 years, you have a Democratic governor. For the first time in 40 years, you have a Republican-controlled legislature. Why did not one follow the other?
Voter anger.
Well, against
they were
both.
Switching parties in both
in
cases. Both,
exactly. And here's another thing. All the Republicans said, we're not going to have any more spending. We're going to cut spending. We're going to cut
only
government.
Tax cuts, no tax increases.
Mark Dayton said that you elect me, I'm going to tax millionaires. I'm going to tax the rich.
And so everybody is trying to fulfill their campaign
and they have.
Promises, and they have, and it's broken the government down.
But that's what's interesting. So what was the message of Minnesota in 2010? Was it that they wanted a Republican legislature, or they wanted a Democratic governor, or both?
They wanted different.
They wanted different.
And
well,
they wanted
got
better
different.
Results. And oftentimes, by getting different, what you get is worse results.
Whereas in Ohio, for example, which has a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, John Kasich got everything he wanted. He got the budget deficit solved. He's cut entitlement taxes. He's cut all the state taxes. But now all those burdens are going to fall onto local government, who are probably going to have to raise their own taxes.
And how is John Kasich doing in the polls in Ohio?
His numbers have declined not that badly, but since the budget battles and the fights against the unions and the Senate Bill 5, which curtails collective bargaining for public employees, his numbers have declined a bit.
And how does that stack up against, say, Scott Walker or Rick Scott down in Florida?
Scott's numbers are even worse.
In Florida. Worse in the country, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he's certainly, he's really way down there, and Republicans are very nervous about a lot of these House seats they won in 2010, whether they can hold them in 2012 with the specter of Rick Scott as the titular leader of the GOP.
And how about New Christie in Chris Christie?
His numbers are still not terrible. He's combative, and the Democratic legislature hates his guts. The president of the state Senate this week called him a rotten bastard. There's no love lost, but, that's exactly what Chris Christie wants to hear.
It is, because this is the combativeness.
It's me against the unions. It's me against the Democrats.
He thrives on this.
He does.
And going just a little further down into the granular detail, we have an extraordinary special election for the United States House of Representatives out in the Los Angeles area this week.
On Tuesday,
in California.
Tuesday.
The district number is 36.
That's right. That's the Jane Harmon seat. She gave up the seat. And
to become Jane Harmon.
Right, .org. But here's the thing. The fact that Janice Hahn is running against Craig Huey and his two brothers.
Louie and Dewey.
That's correct. And the Republican nominee. This is a pretty solid Democratic seat. But the fact that Janice Hahn is not mentioning the fact that she's a Democrat in the ads and she's really doing negative stuff against Huey makes me wonder whether the Democrats are nervous that this seat could be closer than they expect. I still think the Democrats hold it.
It's a pretty fundamentally Democratic district, as most all of the Southern California districts are drawn to be one or the other party's playpen. But in this particular case, with voter anger and with only the motivated voter showing up for an extraordinarily unusual July 12th election in California, this is just not on anybody's radar. I understand the sun shines rather often down there and the beaches are kind of nice. So getting people out to vote on Tuesday, July 12th is not going to be easy.
There are two more special elections to talk about. Both happen on September 13th. There's news this week in Nevada. That's a seat that Dean Heller gave up to be appointed to the U.S. Senate to fill the John Ensign Senate seat. And this is a seat that, since it was created in 1982, has always gone Republican.
It's called the Cow Counties seat, is it?
Is it? Is it?
Yeah, because it's more the rural areas of the state.
What happened, what initially was planned, was that all the candidates were going to run on the same ballot, and there were several Republicans, including Sharron Angle at one point, although she since said she would not run.
Sharron Angle, who was, of course, the Republican nominee against Harry Reid last fall,
Who lost. And so the Republicans feared that in an open election with a lot of Republicans on the ballot, the lone Democrat, Kate Marshall, the state treasurer, was going to win it. But the state Supreme Court came down this week with a ruling that said that the party bosses could anoint a candidate.
Was that the way that they worded it? The court said party bosses may anoint a candidate?
They may have said party leaders, but yes, that's exactly what they said. And Mark Amodei, who's a former state Republican chairman, will be the Republican nominee, and that's good news for the GOP because it eliminates the battle of a Republican vote being split.
But this is a very Republican area, so at least as much as the California 36 is Democratic.
Probably more so,
This should be a lockdown for them.
And in New York's 9th congressional district, the one that Anthony Weiner regrettably gave up because...
What happened to Anthony Weiner?
He had a Twitter town hall meeting. And what happened, the Democratic leaders / bosses announced just Thursday morning that David Weperin, a state assemblyman, will be the Democratic nominee for that seat. In the history of that district, it has never gone Republican. I predict the Democrats will hold on to that seat in September 13th.
So are you willing to make a blanket prediction that the two parties will hold on to the seats that we've just been discussing?
I do.
On the other hand,
yes.
One more thing for just the upcoming week, July 12th. A little bit of sympathy for the voters of 9 state Senate districts in the state of Wisconsin. Mm. Because we have a rather complicated system here where 6 Republican state senators are subject to recall because of petition drives that successfully got them on the ballot. And then there are three Democrats who are also subject. This, of course, came out of that huge mess last winter when the Democrats left the state Senate and hid out in Illinois trying to prevent the passage of an anti-union law or an anti-public union law in the state of Wisconsin. It eventually got passed. It's just been put into law and okayed by the state Supreme Court this past month. And now we have the anger on the left of Democrats and union supporters trying to recall six of the Republican senators who voted for that bill, while concerned conservatives or angry Republicans or whatever you want to call them have gotten three of those Democratic state senators who fled to Illinois onto a recall ballot as well. I wish we could say that next Tuesday all nine of those state Senate races were going to be decided, but we don't really have it that simple. There are going to be some votes next Tuesday, some primaries to decide which Democratic candidate is running against which Republican state senator. So it's going to take a little while to resolve over the space of this summer. But we may get a strong indication this coming Tuesday, the 12th, of just which party has the upper hand in these specials.
And that's part of the politics of anger that we're seeing in 2011. It was run by the conservative. The Republicans had the monopoly on the anger in 2010. We wonder if the Democrats are taking the lead in 2011. We saw 1.3 million signatures in Ohio to repeal Senate Bill 5 to put it on the ballot in November, the one in the public employees, you know, curtailing public the pension rights.
Yes, even more so than in Wisconsin.
But 1.3 million signatures, far more than they needed. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that it will pass in November, but the question is whether the anger we saw coming from the Republicans in 2010 can be duplicated by the Democrats in 2011.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Tack it up, buddy, gonna shut you down. It happened on the strip where the road is wide. Two cool shorts standing side by side. Yeah, I feel